This is Friday, the 4th of November, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, as Election Day approaches, things are getting more and more personal between the two major candidates.
But just remember, the system is rigged. Just remember that.
We've all seen all we need of Donald Trump.
Jim Malone joins us to talk about that. Also ahead, Jill Malandrino is here with word of the latest U.S. job figures and what they mean. And VOA's Jeff Selden has the latest on the Iraqi advance into Mosul. All on today's International Edition. Well, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are holding simultaneous dueling campaign rallies. Last night, they did it in North Carolina, a state that must be won in order to win the White House next Tuesday. Clinton's former rival for the Democratic nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders, introduced Clinton in Raleigh, while Republican Trump was a short distance away, speaking to a largely pro-military crowd in Selma. Both traded the usual insults about the other's fitness for office while appealing to their followers that their vote matters. Earlier in Greenville, North Carolina, Clinton warned that Trump always puts himself first and doesn't care who gets hurt along the way. She said Trump simply cannot help himself when he insults women and minorities, adding that he's out of his depth and very dangerous. She told her audience to picture what a Trump campaign and a Trump presidency would look like.
But just remember, the system is rigged. Just remember that. And reports also show the political leadership at the Department of Justice is trying to protect Hillary Clinton and is interfering with the FBI's criminal investigation.
Well, obviously, that wasn't Hillary Clinton. That was Donald Trump. So hopefully this is Hillary Clinton.
The truth is, we don't have to imagine what that would be like, because everything Donald Trump has said and done, both in his career and in this campaign, is a preview of what could happen. You know, as Michelle Obama says, the presidency doesn't change who you are, it reveals who you are. And we've all seen all we need of Donald Trump.
Well, joining us in studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, it's really gotten lower and lower and lower as far as personal attacks are concerned. Which ones are sticking? What do you think?
Well, for a moment, let me talk about why it's focusing on the attacks. The Clinton campaign, about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, decided to try to go more positive because they felt they were winning, and she wanted to present a more uplifting message in hopes of winning over undecided voters at the end. Because her numbers have dipped and Trump is surging now, they've decided they have to go back to recasting him as temperamentally unfit to be commander-in-chief and president. So that's why on the Clinton campaign, they've gone back to their core argument, he's not fit. His argument continues to be about her trustworthiness related to the email issue, which, of course, was aided by the Comey announcement just a week ago that they're looking at more material in connection with that. But the other thing Trump is doing, he's running a few more ads, and he's talking more as an agent of change. This generically can help an outsider candidate in the final stages of a campaign, if that message is allowed to stick.
So the number of states, I should say, have been reduced down to a precious few. What are they and why?
Well, they were, but here's the thing. Where are the candidates going? Clinton and her surrogates are going to some of the Democratic states, some of the so-called blue states, like Michigan, which, frankly, shouldn't be in play if she's in a safe position. So Bill Clinton's going to Detroit to try to rally African-American voters. That's key because there's early indications the black vote is down compared to what it was in 2012. Somewhat expected because Barack Obama's not on the ballot, but now they're pulling out all the stops to try to get that Democratic coalition energized. On the other hand, Latino voters seem to be spiking in certain states like Nevada, Colorado, and even Florida, and that could be a plus for the Democrats, both parties trying to read the tea leaves on the early voting.
Now, overall, I'm sure, in fact, I know you have seen the same New York Times CBS News poll that I have this morning saying that Americans are pretty fed up with this whole campaign.
Yeah. And, you know, from the start, it's been a pretty ugly campaign. There's been a lot of rhetoric, charged feelings. And of course, in the final stages now, each of them are trying to disqualify the other. Trump trying to cite Clinton's untrustworthiness and Clinton trying to cite Trump's temperament as they make their final case to the voters. Here's the thing. Is the election going to solve the partisan divide? Is that all going to go away? No. And the closer the election is, the more hard feelings there may be on either side. So it could be a rough period, not only up through election night, but even beyond.
There are some open wounds and a lot of them. Andrew Palczewski joins us checking social media. I take some of these trends continue through social media or even been amplified through some.
Absolutely. And you see a lot of people kind of going to their corner for their candidate and trying to engage in some of this gamesmanship and saying, well, this candidate is going to win because of this reason or this poll is up. You know, Jim has talked on the show before how polls are kind of snapshots and people take them when we get these snapshots and try to extrapolate them on social media into, you know, whether it means victory or which state is going to go which way. But the one thing that a lot of people are talking about, especially I think the Democrats, is the early voting, saying, well, these polls may have tightened, but they're not reflecting the people who have voted early. And in that, they say that Hillary Clinton has a strong edge, especially with those Hispanic voters. But then you have Trump supporters that go back and refute that and say, well, we're up in Ohio. And Hillary people say, no, we're up here. So it's a lot of this back and forth on social media that we're seeing and we're going to see probably through Tuesday. And then even beyond, there are some people noting, you know what, this doesn't end on November 8th. It's going to continue in one way or another.
What about this this thing about people being disgusted with the campaigns?
I think that's an understatement. I think there's a lot of distaste for this election, for the way it's gone. There's a lot of people saying, why aren't we focusing on the issues? I didn't hear about this issue that I'm interested in. I didn't get to hear about climate change, or I didn't get to hear about education. A lot of these issues kind of get swept away when the news cycle focuses on the back and forth and kind of the personal attacks. So a lot of people really unhappy with that. So they are looking forward to, in 4 days from now, the election happening and being over, but they're also recognizing that some of these things aren't going to go away and they're going to continue through.
A lot of things are not going to go away. Andrew, thank you so much. Andrew Palczewski, Jim Malone, make sure you stay with VOA as we provide you with complete election coverage this coming Tuesday on VOA platforms, including radio, web, and social media. This is VOA. Among the stories we're covering for you in the world, three U.S. military trainers have been killed in an exchange of gunfire at an airbase. Iraq military says its special forces recaptured 6 districts of eastern Mosul, expanding the army's foothold in the Islamic State. Attorneys representing the Democratic and Republican parties are arguing before a federal judge over allegations Republicans are coordinating with Donald Trump to suppress or intimidate minority voters. Hundreds of French police began dismantling a huge migrant camp in northeastern Paris on Friday. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The modern smartphone is a light and tiny device that fits in the palm of your hand. And it can link you to the internet, take photos and videos, and oh yeah, make and receive telephone calls and texts. Some people say they couldn't live a day without theirs. But are smartphones making us less trusting of others? Authors of a newly released study gauge the relationship between access to mobile information technology and trust by surveying over 2,000 Americans. The survey included questions such as how often they depend on mobile information technology and how much they trust other groups of people, including family, neighbors, and strangers. The results of the research, published in the journal PLOS ONE, suggest that the more a person depends on smartphones for information, the less likely they are to trust other people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
On Tuesday, November 8th, all eyes will be on America as voters choose the next U.S. president. Tune in to our live comprehensive coverage with our correspondents around the country and around the world, starting Tuesday at 2200 hours UTC GMT and continuing through Wednesday morning right here on VOA.
This is International Edition. U.S. stocks are trading, or had been trading, at least slightly higher for most of the morning following the all-important employment report, which came in line with expectations. With details on what is moving the markets, we welcome Jill Melandrino, business correspondent from our VOA office and studios in New York City. Jill, what's it look like?
All right. Well, in a New York minute, this jobs report did come in line, and we saw that reaction in the futures market and as the market opened flat across the board. Currently, traders see an 80% chance that we will, in fact, get that rate hike on December 14th based on this employment data. And we still have one more coming out on December 2nd as well. So as long as these continue to come in line and we see wage growth and unemployment tick down, I think we're going to get that rate hike. Now, everything, of course, is focused on next Tuesday with the election. Traders view a Clinton win as more stable for the markets, as it will be more of the same and her policies will most likely echo Barack Obama's. Trump, on the other hand, whether you like him or not, is viewed as an unknown, and that lends to uncertainty in markets. In other words, Trump is viewed as a wild card simply because it is not status quo, and it will take time for markets to adjust following the result, but they will adjust as history serves for a guide. Over the past 80 years, many disruptive policies have come and gone. We've had recessions, periods of high inflation, interest rate spikes, Federal Reserve rate hike cycles, wars, terrorist attacks, etc. Through it all, S&P 500 companies have grown profits by an average of 8% annually.
Well, I know how you always talk, and so does everybody else in your business, in the financial business, about uncertainty. And there certainly is probably the highest level uncertainty ever. This doesn't mean that the investors necessarily don't like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It's just the uncertainty, right?
That's exactly it, because you have Hillary Clinton where there's clearly some question in terms of what direction she will take the country. And then also you have Donald Trump. Love him or hate him, there's just a lot of uncertainty in terms of what his policy may be, because he is, in fact, a D.C. outsider. But just like we saw happen with Brexit back in June, we had 2 or 3 days of about a sell-off. It represented a fantastic buying opportunity. So for retail investors, I would recommend keeping powder dry, as we say. Don't adjust your portfolios and look for buying opportunities based on the reaction we get in the markets.
We shall see, and we'll know a lot more when we speak again next week, eh?
Yes, we will.
Jill Melandrino reporting our financial report live from New York City. You're listening to International Edition. Heavy fighting erupted in the eastern neighborhoods of Mosul today as Iraqi special forces launched an assault deeper into the urban areas of the city, and Islamic State militants fired back. VOA correspondent, national security correspondent Jeff Selden has made his way into our International Edition studios. And Jeff, what's the latest as you have it?
Well, the latest is that the Iraqi forces are claiming they are making some progress, taking a number of districts in the outer parts of Mosul right now. They've been making good progress up to this point. The Pentagon here in the U.S., military officials saying that they are on schedule for the campaign to retake Mosul from Islamic State fighters. But one thing to remember is as they get closer and closer to the center of the city, the more difficult the fighting is going to get. Military officials have warned that Islamic State plans to basically turn Mosul into hell on earth, that they've filled pits with oil, they have all sorts of booby traps, IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and they've had 2 years to really dig in and do defense in depth, as military officials like to say. So they expect that the fighting will be bloody, it will be long, it will be difficult. We've also seen some new satellite images that have come out recently of Mosul itself, which appears to show that Islamic State has cleared some buildings, has razed them themselves to get a better line of sight for approaching forces, especially on the southern edge of the city, that they've also barricaded a number of routes into the city. So it's possible to overcome some of that with air power, which the U.S. will be providing and other coalition members, but it's still expected to be a much tougher fight the deeper into the city that the Iraqi forces get.
Now, the IS leader had some messages for his membership remaining in Mosul and even those outside. Is that having an effect? Can we tell yet?
It's not really possible to tell just yet, but from what military officials have told me, intelligence officials have told me, there are no signs of panic among the Islamic State fighters, even as the Iraqi forces and the Kurdish forces were advancing towards Mosul from the north, from the east, and from the south. There was no, and in many cases, Islamic State was just backing up, cutting and running, and falling back to different positions. No sign of panic, no sign of concern, no sense that they were going to make this an easy fight. A lot of the retreats were strategic, and where they chose to fight, they fought hard.
There have been dire predictions and dire tales of what is going to happen and what is happening with the civilian population of Mosul, many of them leaving the city but facing some challenges.
Absolutely. There's concern that a lot of the camps, the displaced person camps that have been set up around Mosul, aren't quite ready, never got the funding that the international community was calling for to set them up properly, to set up enough. Remember, you're talking about a city that had anywhere from 1.2 to 1.5 million people, and most of them, especially in the center of the city and in the city itself, have not yet left. They've been staying in place, which is what the Iraqi military had wanted them to do. But at some point, they may feel the need to flee. And if they do, there's a lot of concern that the international community simply won't, and the aid groups on the ground won't be able to cope with the outflow.
What happened to the money? Why didn't it show up?
They said the international groups were saying, the aid groups were saying, we need this much money. And donors came forward. Many of the coalition countries came forward and donated money. But in the end, it wasn't sufficient for what the aid groups wanted, which could be one of the reasons that the Iraqi military started telling the people inside Mosul, the civilians, stay in place. They also argued it was going to be easier and it would be safer because it would make less of a chance that Islamic State would try to use civilians as human shields. But already, there's been evidence that Islamic State is positioning civilians in various places to use them to protect themselves as they flee or try to maneuver against the Iraqi military.
Jeff Selton, appreciate it.
Anytime.
Let's move on now on International Edition from VOA. It's been nearly 4 years since 20 children and 6 educators were gunned down at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. VOA's David Byrd tells us about Newtown. That's a new documentary that looks at the effect the massacre had on the small town as well as the entire country.
John, 911, what's the location of your emergency?
Sandy Hook Elementary School, 12 Dickinson Drive.
Okay, what's going on down there?
I believe there's shooting at the front glass. Something's
okay.
Going on.
I want you to take cover. Jen, get everybody you can going down there.
It's still happening.
The film opens with the horrified voices of people calling 911 to report the shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. The new documentary, Newtown, uses first-person interviews with some of the victims' families, neighbors, and co-workers to tell the story. Mark Barden's son, Daniel, was one of those killed.
I still have a little secrets stashed around. He used to wear this old yellow football helmet when he'd ride in the little seat in the back of my bicycle. And I have that in the garage, and it still has some beautiful little long blonde hairs of his in it.
In one scene, Nicole Hockley, whose son Dylan was also shot, shows a room stacked with boxes of condolence cards, gifts, and other items from well-wishers.
This is most of the stuff that's been, I don't even know how many thousands of letters and gifts and portraits. So many of them have never been opened because I just can't do that yet.
Kim Snyder, who also directed Welcome to Shelbyville about Somali refugee immigrants in small-town America, is Newtown's director.
And we felt we had not seen a film like this that had really looked at the trajectory of up to 3 years. We filmed over the course of 3 years. Sadly, there's been so many since, but I think Newtown for so many people was a watershed moment and really needed to be, you know, we needed to bear witness to that so that with the hope that we can, that something could change.
Maria Cuomo Cole is the film's producer. She says that the filmmakers wanted to remain sensitive to the pain community members were in, but also wanted to highlight the bravery and endurance shown by Newtown.
Kim and I felt it was extremely important to be as sensitive as possible, of course, in telling this important story, a story that, you know, we don't have the luxury to forget in America. It's, you know, it's hard stuff, but it's part of who we are. And hopefully, you know, we can learn from it and create change to keep communities safe.
Do you promise to live life to its fullest?
I do!
Do you promise to cherish family and friends?
I do!
The film takes a hopeful turn when it shows community members taking part in the Daniel Barden Mudfest, an endurance race that benefits several charities. Nicole Hockley has also been able to go into the room of condolence gifts and to start opening some of them. The issue of gun control has been hotly debated in this year's presidential campaign. Maria Cuomo said her hope is that Newtown will touch people's hearts on both sides of the issue and will result in change. That change has still not arrived. Earlier this year, the deadliest massacre in modern U.S. history took place in Orlando, with 49 people gunned down at a nightclub. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
This is International Edition. Now, remember the cover of the National Geographic? Many of you are probably too young to remember it, but it was the picture of a beautiful Afghan refugee girl with beautiful, beautiful green eyes. Well, a court in the northwestern Pakistani city of Peshawar today ordered that the green-eyed Afghan girl be deported once her detention expires. The case of Sharbat Gula, who was arrested 10 days ago after allegedly forging ID papers and staying in Pakistan illegally, has drawn international attention and criticism of Pakistan authorities. You have been listening to International Edition. You can like us at voanews.com, Facebook at VOA Now, or Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks to our director, Steve Karish, our engineer, Pete Hundley. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The North Korea regime continues to refuse to give up its autocratic and repressive ways, said U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a speech in Seoul, South Korea. This is a regime, he said, that operates enormous political prison camps at home, denies its citizens nearly all basic rights, and imposes a system of surveillance and censorship so repressive it has no comparison in the modern age. This is a regime that prioritizes nuclear weapons and missiles over the well-being of the North Korean people and is the only regime in the world to test a nuclear weapon in the 21st century. Against this threat, said Deputy Secretary Blinken, the United States is committed to protecting ourselves, defending our allies, meeting our treaty obligations, and providing extended deterrence guaranteed by the full spectrum of U.S. defense capabilities. The U.S. and its partners will not accept North Korea as a nuclear state. Through diplomacy, deterrence, and pressure, the international community will build a comprehensive and sustained campaign that increases the cost on North Korea until it returns to serious talks on denuclearization and complies with its international obligations and commitments. After this year's North Korean nuclear and missile tests, the U.S. and South Korea decided to deploy the THAAD missile defense system to South Korea. The U.S. has also modernized its alliance with Japan, another frequent target of North Korea's threats, updating guidelines that hadn't been revised in over 17 years. North Korea's diplomatic position will continue to weaken as its behavior invites growing isolation and condemnation around the world. Earlier this year, the United States sanctioned Kim Jong-un and 14 other senior officials associated with the regime's grave human rights abuses. Moreover, China and Russia, North Korea's traditional guarantors, are growing tired of defending the increasingly erratic and outlying regime. "The objective is simple and straightforward," said Deputy Secretary Blinken. "It's not to bring Kim Jong-un to his knees. It is to bring him back to the table for meaningful, credible talks on denuclearization. Until then, we will continue to sharpen the choice for North Korea so that it understands, as much as it does not want to denuclearize, the alternative for North Korea will be worse."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.